Ricky Ellison, I'm the founder and chairman of the Missile Defense Advocacy Alliance. We founded the alliance in 2003, right after our country made the decision to withdraw from the ABM Treaty. We were founded to publicly advocate for missile defense. We believe it makes our world a safer place, and we've been in place since then. I've been involved with missile defense since 1980 and was a young student with Governor Ronald Reagan and the introduction of SDI going way back then. We're a nonprofit. We don't push for any specific system. We are about making our world safer through the deployment of missile defenses around the world. I have just come back from a 12-day missile defense tour in Korea, in Japan, in Guam, and flew in from Hawaii last night. We were there to recognize over 80 missile defense soldiers, airmen, that are in place today in those very regions in defending against the North Korean threat. This is something that we've done over the years in bringing forth recognition of excellence of leadership to them. We started in Yongsong Army Garrison in Seoul. On the day of the HS-15 launch, we were in Korea on that day, and our recognition event was during that day later on. We had the opportunity to bring forward representatives of the Patriot crews of South Korea, their 2nd Brigade and their 3rd Brigade, as well as their brigade commander. We had, for the first time in the United States, our most integrated missile defense land-based crews that we've ever done before. So we had the THAAD crew that was deployed, that is deployed today, and members of them. We had the Avenger, the Avengers that are, and the Sentinel radars that are protecting the THAAD in South Korea, and we had our Patriot soldiers there as well. We then went to Japan in Okinawa and did the 1-1, which is our Patriot battalion that is there protecting that island, and recognized them along with the Japanese. They have both their air forces and their Patriot units in Okinawa, and also their army, their short-range missile defense capabilities, which are the Tangsang. I think it's Tan and Sung, a version of the probably a little bit more greater range than the Avengers that we have. We went to Tokyo. We had an opportunity to meet with the general of the Air Force for Tokyo, General Sugiyama. And then we went over to Guam, where we were there when the B-1s left to do the exercise last week, and was there with our THAAD unit and recognized our THAAD unit that's in deployment there. And then we finished off in Hawaii on December 7th. We have our 94th AAMDC command, which oversees all our missile defense systems in the Pacific. And they brought in their team and recognized some of their excellence that was there. So I wanted just to, a couple of quick viewpoints on what we've seen, and starting with from my perspective, from a layman's perspective on the outside of it. But we know that the Korean Peninsula is where the cutting edge of integrated air missile defense is for the world. It is the first place and first time that we've had the THAAD battery having to operate with the Patriot units. The THAAD radar has far better discrimination capabilities in targeting than the Patriot radars. This is the only brigade in the world that has the PDB-8, most modernized brigade, with the MSC missiles. So the MSC missiles, which have a greater range than the Patriot 3s, are all in place in Korea. So that integration is absolutely critical. That's the layered piece that Clem will talk to you about on it. At the North Korean test, there isn't a shock, there isn't a change. That economy, that city is thriving. So they are not affecting the economy or the life of the South Koreans in what's going on with the North Korean leader and those testing aspects of it. You should know that South Korea has 11 divisions on the DMZ, very, very confident, morale super high, and you know their ability to defend, and there's not a legitimate threat by the North Koreans to beat that force that is up there. They're not going to invade the South Korea aspect of it. In Japan, the 1-1 Patriot Battalion there supported the modernization in Korea. So they sent their battalions, they sent their Patriots over there to help while they modernized the Patriots in Korea. They are the next ones getting the MSC missiles and getting the PDB-8s. And obviously the weather there is very difficult for our maintenance and so forth because of the tropical situations that are there. The layered aspect for Japan and for the Japanese is really based on their Aegis Congo ships, which have the fundamental first generation or SM-3 Block 1A missiles on it for their first shot, and their Patriot, they have six or seven Patriot battalions. That is their layered defense that they rely on. They are obviously very concerned with the HS-15, with the ICBM speeds that it showed, and creating a layered defense. They are really looking into the Aegis Ashore based in Japan to create an IMD as well as a BMD capability on that. They are looking at Korea and the THAAD because the Olympics are going to be in Korea this next year, and watching how that's going to work when they look at hosting the Olympics in 2020 on that aspect of it. Moving back to Guam, we know that really for the first time our Navy is with their baseline 9 ships, and their ships are out front having to defend a territory for the first time. The Navy's ships have been part of our BMD architecture for the U.S. homeland in helping with the sensor part of it, but now for the first time they've had to be out front as our first shot opportunity against North Korea on the island of Guam. So they are working that process through, and behind that obviously is our THAAD system that is in place today defending Guam, and certainly defending our ability to push offense out there, as you saw with the B-1s and the B-52s that come back and forth. With Guam, we've noticed, and I've spent some time with Lieutenant Governor, that there has been a dramatic economic effect on the threat that was stated by the North Korean leader on Guam. They've had a 40% decrease in tourism, mostly Japanese, this last month. So they are very concerned about that part of it. Moving to Hawaii, I think, and the Pacific are watching how the Navy is able to defend an island from their ship platform on it. We know we've got 44 GBIs, limited number. We're going to have to wait a couple years before the next RKV comes in. So there is a vulnerability there, or a gap, perceived gap, if the North Koreans continue to produce certainly the HS-15 and others. But that's where there is room to look at an underlayer of defense, which is the SM-3 Block 2A, which they're looking at possibly testing that against ICBM speeds on that. So that's sort of just a broad perspective from my perspective. I want to now introduce our keynote speaker. I apologize for Rear Admiral John Hill. John Hill, he had other obligations today. He let me know on Friday, so we apologize for that. But Clem is the number one guy. He is the number one flag officer in the Pentagon on IMD and missile defense. He is the guy. There's nobody higher ranking than him on that. Clem, I've got to know Clem way back at War College in Carlisle on that, and he got the opportunity to command the world's biggest air defense brigade, the 11th Imperial Brigade, before he got this position that he's in today. He's an up-and-comer, and I'm going to pass you over to him, but I say, Clem, besides layered missile defense for the U.S., you might want to work on the Redskins.
I know.
This past yesterday on that score.
Happy Rhett got a victory yesterday, so we look pretty good. So thanks, Ricky, and appreciate the you guys taking time out of your Monday morning to come here. I know it's not the easiest thing to do. Rear Admiral John Hill, my partner in the Missile Defense Agency, really, really great teammate. And unfortunately, he couldn't be here, but I think he couldn't be here because the loss they took this weekend. And so he might be
wallowing
a little bit. Army had a great weekend, and the Navy did not. But he really, really extends his regards as he kind of pushes through some other issues. And as Ricky stated, I've kind of grown up doing this in the field. I got a former soldier teammate of mine in the back right there. Was Specialist Mixon, you know, years ago when I was a battalion commander. And now Miss Mixon, she kind of moves through into her new transitional life here. But, you know, I do. I really love serving with troops. I love serving in the field. I've had the opportunity to serve from the platoon leader level from Desert Storm, where 42 Scuds came into to Israel to setting conditions in Israel as a battalion executive officer and operations officer to commanding forces in the CENTCOM area of operations overseas as we set the globe over there. So I have done a little bit of this stuff at the tactical level. The hard part is what I'm doing right now, and that's when you're working the requirements and the programming and the resource business, because there's just too many levers out there to pull on. And you think, okay, we have a need out there, we have a requirement here, and then we field capability, and we should be good to go. At the end of the day, there's always competing demands of policy. There's never enough. There's different spikes in the globe that certainly require air defense capacity on a month-to-month basis. It could change. You know, when I came into brigade command in 2012, it was all things with the Iranian threat. And for obvious reasons, it's all things about U.S. Forces Korea right now. And that's what my team, who's kind of represented back here with Mike Solis and Ron Crowther, helped me do on a daily basis. I wear three hats in what I do in the Pentagon as part of the J-8, kind of the resource and the requirements business. I do have the integrated missile defense hat, and that's what I'm here today for. But I also have what's called the protection hat, which these days deals with counter-unmanned aerial systems, which is something that's near and dear to our hearts as we look at the air domain. And the other piece is the Joint Requirements Office, which deals with chemical and biological defense. And I say those three things because they kind of vex on each other when you look at the fact that if you did a Venn diagram, ballistic missiles can deliver weapons of mass destruction. Counter-UAS is still an air threat and an air challenge in the air domain that we deal with. And certainly integrating that as the integrated air missile defense hat that I wear here has to bring all of that together. So it's kind of good having that whole portfolio, because they kind of look over the fence and they see each other really on a daily basis. In the warfighting requirement, we look at this in warfighting requirements from urgent and emerging needs. As Ricky stated, you know, we have two major Army air defense platforms over on the peninsula right now, and that's Patriot and the THAAD weapon system. And so one of our challenges right now, and one of our urgencies right now, is to make sure that those two systems can really work seamlessly with each other. And the U.S. Forces Commander General Vince Brooks and Admiral Harris over there has kind of stated that as one of their high priorities. And so that's important that we look at from the building, and we make sure that the funding's there and that the research and development is there and the modernization is heading in that direction. And then the other piece we look at is studies and analysis. You have to understand that you can't just look at the threat as of yesterday or the next 48 to 72 hours. You got to look and see where this thing is going to be in the next 5 to 7 years. And you got to look hard at yourself, and you have to look at, you know, what are the peer competitors out there that we are faced with, whether it's China, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, whether it's North Korea, and then violent extremists at the same time. So you have to keep pace of not only, you know, the we fight tonight mentality out there, but it's how do you start looking at what are we going to need for the future? And as we kind of start determining what those requirements are, because a lot of them have long lead times. These things don't develop overnight. And it's amazing what our men and women do in the labs and the scientists do to really keep pace with what is going on out there. I've had to take a crash course over the last 6 months on space. Okay, I just kind of figured, okay, well, I'm going to get a sensor from into some of the capability that I need for my Patriot and my THAAD systems. It's going to come from certain satellite feeds. But I've had to really kind of peel the onion on that area that I'm really not familiar with, and I'm still kind of learning in progress. And so you kind of go to where your weaknesses are and build up your strength in areas that you have to understand is just as important. Because it really is the next frontier. I mean, it is a fight up there, just as it is a fight on the ground out there, as our infantrymen and our combat infantrymen is dealing with on a daily basis. And so keeping pace with that threat is important. You always have competing demands of modernization versus readiness. You know, you hear our chief of staff of the Army and the chief of staff of the Air Force, and really all the service chiefs and commandants talk about that is really their number one priority. So how do you fight tonight? How do we increase and build the readiness that may have taken a hit over the last several years because of the constant grind of the rotations into the campaigns that we've been dealing with? But once again, that's juxtaposed to the how do we balance that with modernization? And that's a tough fight. And I can speak from the Army's pie. And so the Army's budget is 50%+ for personnel. Okay, we're not a platform-centric service. All right, so we pay our soldiers, entitlements, you name it, what it is first. Okay, and that's 50% to 52%, whatever the time is. And then you're going to put about 30% or so in readiness, and that's our constant operational and maintenance grind of fueling and ensuring that we're maintaining our troops out there, etc. And then the last one, really the last slither of the pie, which isn't all of it, is probably less than 20%, is modernization. And so you can kind of see where that can get out of balance. But that's a challenge. I mean, every service chief has to look at that and say, okay, where do I mortgage today's capability against what we need for in the future? And so we look at that as well in the hats that we wear in the building as you look out into the out years. Because you do want to focus on capacity. You can read in the open source press that, you know, this administration, the president, we have strong concurrence to increase our funding for missile defense. So what does that really mean? I mean, do you put that into all in R&D, or do you put that into capacity? Do you buy more missiles? Do you buy more sensors? Do you buy things that might improve today's fight over the next couple of years, or do you look once again about 5 to 10 years? And we go back and forth, you know, depending on who's arguing this or making a statement on either side, that can be challenging. Policy's going to look at it maybe a little different than scientists and technologists. Military's going to look at it maybe different than a think tank out there. But we want to bring all of these different competing thoughts together. And it's important to have that professional friction out there understanding these challenges. The last thing I'll say before we take any questions, because I think that's the most important part, is working, as Ricky said, on host nation integration, host nation partnership. What does that really mean? And it's not a one-size-shoe-fits-all for any country out there. Things that we do with our partners in the Middle East may be different what we're doing in the Asia-Pacific, may be different what we're doing in Europe, depending on the relationship, depending on the current policy with that country, depending on what they have purchased. You know, we are learning a lot, frankly speaking, the U.S. is, from the Emiratis and the Saudi Arabians as they prosecute a campaign against the Houthis in Yemen. And so I say that because at the same time you ask yourself, all right, well, they're shooting very expensive missiles at a very cheap adversary or threat out there, but it goes back to, you know, will we engage a nickel, you know, with $1,000 if it's to save a life? Absolutely. All right, and you know, you'll do the forensics and you'll play Monday morning quarterback afterwards and say, okay, well, we're shooting at these very cheap quadcopters or whatever it is, or inexpensive threats capabilities that our adversaries are using, but we're using $1 million missiles, or I'm just kind of using that, you know, hypothetically, because I think we know they're a lot more expensive than that, in order to counter that. So once again, we have to get back into the building and look left of that problem. You know, once again, what can we do maybe to thwart or mitigate that threat out there prior to it, us having to actually deal with it in a kinetic fashion. So those are the kind of the, you know, that's my inbox, if I can kind of share that with you on a daily basis, a little bit of my background. And certainly, Ricky, thanks for doing this and giving us an opportunity to speak. And I always learn something sometimes more than sometimes I came here with the knowledge. So appreciate this.
Thanks, Glenn. Thank you. This is a very open forum where we want to express your opinions and your thoughts, and being able to take advantage of Clem here and being able to understand the picture in Korea and the layered defenses that our country has and where we're going. So I'd like to open up to you to ask any question you would like.
Sir? In the recent budget supplemental of $4 billion that had a lot to do with missile defense, there was a bunch having to do with left-of launch capability, cyber capability. Can you discuss a little bit, as much as you can, in a form like this, what that looks like?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit how you define left of launch, because it can get, it's a complex statement. I think we're kind of used to saying left of launch, but if you ask somebody in policy, or you may ask an ambassador out there, he or she may say, be careful, because does that come across as preemptive? Okay, and so you got to kind of put yourself in the box of, what do we mean by left of launch? Are we talking about pre-launch, etc.? So it can be, you know, as I call it, you know, the grunt on the ground that can get to a tell or a strike package that can affect that capability before it can launch. Two, certainly, as you said, and I could probably leave it at this, you know, whether it be a cyber mean or certainly electronic capability that can work, because the same is going to be done to us. I mean, that certainly, we got to look at the coin from both ends there. But it goes back to my previous statement of, Do we sit back with the catcher's mitt and continue just to wait for the wave after wave of a potential threat to come to U.S. protected assets? Or can we potentially look at putting some research and development and capability ahead of that launch? And that's, I know it sounds kind of just very basic and primitive, but that's sort of the overarching concept there.
Can I follow up on that with something that you said reminded me that there's been a lot in the news recently about microwave emitting missiles and a capability that was developed by Boeing years and years ago to disrupt circuits, and you sort of fly something over an area and it can sort of microwave out all the electronics.
Yeah.
A couple of news agencies have put out stories saying that this is something that's actively being looked at. I don't know if you can comment on that, but
yeah.
I
can't, but that's the first time I saw it. I think I saw it on CBS News or something like that about a week ago, you know. And so, there are things behind the curtain, but I would tell you that's the first open source type capability. And my hunch is these things are being presented in that fashion, frankly speaking, I think to galvanize some of the expertise that we have out in America that may not understand this technology, that invites them into the labs to start looking at this. That's just Coward's opinion, all right. But that's certainly a way of looking at that. But that gets back to your point. We're looking at how do we come up with those complex and science means to deal with it. So thanks, sir.
Question: so GMD, even before RKV's field, protects going today. I think that's what NDA advertises. Can you speak to when you talk about Venus Ashore?
You want to go first? I'll jump in.
I think we right now are limited with a number that we can't change, and because by the time we change it, the RKV is coming forward and the MOKV or so forth are coming forward. So you have a window of a gap opportunity. You have a demonstrated ICBM lofted launch two Tuesdays ago. So those regions right now in Korea, in Japan, in Guam, don't have a defense against that specific ICBM speed, because those systems aren't required or proven to deal with that. So there is urgency to try and find a move forward, because the SM3 Block 2A, and Jim Searing, the former MDA director, in testimony said it had capability to defeat ICBM speeds. That missile's co-developed with Japan, and Japan is right at the front lines wanting a capability as soon as possible. So I think you'll see a lot of drive to get that system tested to see if it can do it and proven. And then if you have that, they're already in low rate production today, that you are able to produce a underlayer with our ships that can carry those systems today. The baseline 9 ships can carry those systems today to be able to better defend and give another shot. And frankly, if you got 44, the NORTHCOM combat commander is now in a much difficult, more challenging position, because before, the whole United States was not threatened by the technology. It was just the West Coast and maybe Hawaii. So now the choices now, she's got to defend all those cities. So having Hawaii have a underlayer would help if they could do that. And Guam's got an underlayer. I mean, the other regions have it. So there's some politics here, because NORTHCOM and PACOM are different on that. NORTHCOM's got that responsibility, but Hawaii's a regional defense part of it. So I think you'll see it. I think there's language in Congress going forward for ICBM. There's funding going forward for that, but they've got to prove that technology as soon as possible. And I think Japan, the big partner, is behind that.
And I think your point is correct. Where you can have redundancy, that's always a great thing. That's not a good thing, that's a great thing. And then the other piece is that the length of time that it takes to just develop one missile, to be in a factory, isn't as robust as we would like it to be. Okay, so the sooner we can start moving in that direction, and for that capability, for something else that can have capability against an ICBM, will be a tremendous boost for really the joint force. Yes, ma'am. You were just there, so I'll let you go and speak first, and I can give you
go ahead, start.
The science. So literally, I just got the text that said Victor Chai was just nominated by the president to be the Korean, the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to South. So I think that's a tremendous step right there. General Vince Brooks is probably one of the best senior leaders that we have in today's U.S. military, and he's a U.S. Forces commander. But he's really been doing two hats. He's been wearing both the, you know, the combatant hat. He's also kind of been an ambassador when it comes to kind of working, you know, both the policy and the capability. But I think your question really is at the heart of, will we ever have enough capacity, you know, whether it be on the region to really, I don't say avert the threat, but certainly to combat the threat of the North Korean. And the answer, it goes back to, it depends, you know. And There are so many other elements of combat power that would be utilized, and it's not just going to be this missile defense fight of missiles come over, missiles get engaged, and then, you know, we're just going to see this for an extended period of time. I mean, you know, there's an air campaign, there's a ground campaign, there's a fires campaign at the same time going on, and then there's a political domain that's happening, you know, at the same time. So I think the exercises are always great things. And I say think because I'm not the commander over there, but I do know the commanders over there. And they spend more time, and I go back to my last point I said in my opening comments, on building host nation integration and partnership, because some things just don't always just plug and play. So if I want to have a system that I'm working with the Japanese or I'm working with the South Koreans, we don't just matter, you know, just plug them together and they're going to work automatically. I mean, there's certain things you got to get through in today's environment, so when the time comes and you need to integrate that, we can see what they're looking at, they can see what we're looking at, we're not just all firing at the same threat out there, that we can create potentially a layer defense out there, the better. And that's why these exercises really are good things. And that's not just for the Pacific region, that's certainly even for the Middle East region that we've operated in. and even from back in the Cold War region when we were in Europe. Okay, so I don't know if that helps you or answers your question at all. It's a viable threat. I would tell you that all threats right there are taken very serious. I mean, that's really all I can tell you. I mean, we don't say one is not serious and one is. I think, you know, once a country or an adversary or whatever you want to, how you want to categorize it, has the capability to do that, they're always going to attempt to get better. And the more they do it, they learn from their own mistakes. You know, it's like we learn from our test mistakes. You always gain something from that. So I would submit, and I would that threat is taken very seriously by folks that are on the peninsula as well as our military.
I would just add that, you know, we don't live in a 20 years ago or 10 years ago where we used missile defense as a strategic deterrent on its own. We now are playing with our offense. It's an offense defensive deterrent, and certainly we're not ever going to match exactly or even close to their inventory of capability to strike us. We have that mixed deterrent, and you're seeing that with those exercises. Because of the threat that's continuing to increase, those exercises are very important. That offensive exercise over the last 2 weeks, we had 150 plus sorties in there demonstrating that that offense is with this. So it's really a concern to the populations that you have to have something in place to defend against an accidental or premature launch, that the populations are comfortable and the economies are comfortable. And you're seeing both Japan and Korea still moving very strongly in that aspect because they have defensive capability. And that was huge. That was the only thing on the peninsula that could defeat a ballistic missile at their magnitude that they're going. So I think you're going to see more and more of a mesh between the offense and defense, which we haven't really been practicing as we're going to be doing in the future.
Sir?
Sir, you mentioned that the length of time it takes to appeal to a weapon system. And I think in the last NAA report overview I saw over the missile defense system, it said that THAAD is really a scarce resource. Are you worried whether you can field new units fast enough to take care of worldwide requirements, because it is becoming more needed around the world?
My answer is no. And it goes back to, you know, our government will set what our force caps will look like. And so on the Army active duty side, we're at 480,000, you know, congressionally approved individuals to be on being active duty in various branches, etc., in the Army. And so we have in the Army Air Defense pool, you know, 15 Patriot battalions and 5 and plus 1 THAAD batteries being developed out of Fort Hood. So you can say 6, but you know, it's in a testing and fielding phase right now. But to give us more systems doesn't necessarily mean that I can man those systems too. And so it's sort of like a physics problem at the same time of how do you keep up with, not only we have more airplanes, more ships or whatever, than we have men and women to man them. You have to kind of keep those things in balance. And it has to maintain in balance with whatever our strategy is going to be, our national defense strategy, our national military strategy, ultimately our national security strategy. And how are we going to posture our forces abroad? And I was going to say it at the end of the last question, but you know, when you do send a missile defense capability anywhere in the world since Desert Storm, it has clearly sent a message, you know, whether it be positively or negatively, depending on which side of the country you're on. And so when, you know, once again, I had the fortunate opportunity to send the first THAAD battery into Guam, and we knew that was coming about a week out, and then when it hit the news, it was huge. It really was. And then certainly we watched just the challenge of, you think, what's so hard about bringing just 95 men and women, you know, a radar, a few pieces of equipment, just push them into South Korea, deploy them on an open space here, and then they're ready to fight, you know, just like we do at White Sands Missile Range at Fort Bliss or in El Paso or New Mexico. It comes with political ramifications. What is seen by us as defensive may be seen as offensive by another country out there. And so I will tell you this too. I mean, you know, war plans certainly out exceed the capacity that we currently have. I mean, you know, so we know we have forces in the Middle East. We know we have forces in the Pacific. We know we have very little capability in Europe. But I would guarantee you that each of those competing combat commands probably has probably that number or more needed for the capability that they need for their, if something was to happen, you know, in their theater of operations. So decisions have to be made whether we move capability, recommit them elsewhere. It goes back to my point of, you know, the challenge of who's modernizing now, you know, who's doing testing and research and development. And we do it. We figure it out. We always have. And it comes with a cost. It comes with the cost of personal capital. I mean, soldiers and airmen and you name it, whoever it is, deploying constantly, coming back and forth, being away from home, et cetera. And yeah, you can say, well, that's what they signed up for. We need the capability out there. But the grind takes its toll, and so you start talking about the second, third order effects of who's going to re-enlist for this constant pace out there. You know, 10 years, 7 years in, and you're on your seventh or eighth deployment, you know, and you have more hash stripes like this all the way up to here, and it becomes very challenging. Okay, and so that's something that we certainly have to look at too as a human element. It's not always just about this, hey, the science of putting forces and troops, et cetera, on the ground with capability. It's, you got to reset them, all right? And it takes a lot to train an individual in this very highly skilled area. So I know I kind of rambled on about a question there, but
no,
I
that would have
think
been
it's important.
The cost tempo is incredibly high.
It is.
Forward deployed.
It is. Absolutely. Absolutely.
There's a great example of what just happened in Europe where we took soldiers that were not ADA trained from the second CR, there's a second CR,
yeah,
and the 173rd, and trained them in 6 weeks, and they got out and did Stinger intercepts, and they were in Crete intercepting right off the range with our ADA soldiers. So they were able to force change by having other soldiers with other missions,
yeah,
incorporated into that mission. So that was considerable. And I think what they're going to do in integration with the Patriot and THAAD, which has never been done before, is really going to set where we're going, in whether it's modular brigades or battalions and how we fight, because we've never had to fight like this ever before, where we've had to have all those capabilities in one area. So this is and probably premature to go forward until you figure out exactly what this is, and whether that's, you know, going into IBCS or going into being able to use your best launcher with the best sensor and getting that figured out. I think this has sped up the development and the operations of our IMD tremendously. What's happening?
Absolutely. Sir?
A question for you, General. The integration of all of the sensors, IBCS, where you're fusing your common operating picture and then using the best shooter to go engage the threat, it's a great model. How do you see lasers and railguns and other advanced technologies playing,
yeah,
in that in the future, speaking,
yeah,
of 5 to 7 years?
Yeah,
how do you see that?
Yeah,
bullet,
I think
bullet
it's...
Bullet versus bullet
mm-hmm.
or other technologies?
Right. No, I'm only going off of what I've heard my senior air defense officer say, Lieutenant General Jim Dickinson, out of Space and Missile Defense Command. They are investing a lot of effort into this capability. Had some shoot offs and some capability demonstrations out at White Sands Missile Range, and where they can increase the kilowatt of using laser technology, putting it on potentially a ground based system out there. But at the same time, you know, how high can they go without risking the airspace of potentially whether it be shooting a friendly or anything out there harming more than good, so to speak. And so it is definitely heading in that direction. I mean, it really is. And I don't think we're the only service looking at that. I think, you know, the Navy is as well. But I do see that as certainly a wave of the future.
As those power levels for the lasers go up, mm-hmm. would a firing of a laser to provide defense be less threatening to the enemy than firing a missile?
I'm not sure it would be less threatening. I think it gives us more options and potentially cost-effective options at the same time. And so that is why it's being looked at, you know, in a, I don't say in a super aggressive manner, but certainly in a very programmed approach right now. So. John Hill was here, so he probably lives and breathes this and sees that every day. But I would tell you that, yeah, it's being looked at hard. I mean, it is. I think we have to. I think we have to look at. It goes back to left of launch, boost phase, intercept phase. That, you know, while it's in a downward trajectory, you know, and so all those different layered approaches can and have to be considered in our continued approach to missile defense. You know. So I think we'll get there. I just feel confident about the men and women of this country that we're gonna figure that out, and I think we have to figure it out too. It's just a matter of how we're gonna do it, when we're gonna do it, and when can we field it. And then once you have that capability, how do we incorporate that into the joint force commander's kit bag out there? So,
well, one of the most promising technologies is the UAV above the clouds to do standoff range with a directed energy weapon, solid state. Now that, I think the requirements are 500 kilowatt to do that, and that's a heavy piece of equipment. I think with the we've proved around 150 watt we can do this, but you need to be standing off a couple hundred miles and to be able to shoot a laser beam within a second, burn through a half inch steel or go up through the plume of the rocket as it goes up. That's a game changer, and that's going to require policy to enable that aspect of it, because you're now looking at opening that up to anything that flies on that aspect of it. So it's a policy challenge, and it's a technical challenge that I think is one of the many options that the country is looking at on developing, but it would seem to be the game changer with cost and capability, speed of light weapon, that you don't have to deal with the diffractions underneath the cloud layer where it's clean, and you can go obviously further up than just in atmosphere, and that first 300 seconds of a ballistic missile's flight is vulnerable, and we don't have anything right now to deal with that. We talked about the ARAMs on the F-35, but that's still being discussed and seen if that's even technically possible.
Sir?
Ed, I had a question about Saudi Arabia capability, because the New York Times was important. Saudi Arabia claims
so you're asking the Saudi Arabian threat. Could you say the last?
Push Yemen's ballistic missile.
Okay.
So last month, so November 4th, so Yemen so launched ballistic missile Korea.
Yes.
So, firstly, so Saudi Arabia has announced we intercepted the ballistic
I don't have the facts, I'll be honest with you. And I've seen a couple reports in the building, in the Pentagon. What I will share with you is that that threat isn't being independently researched and developed by just Yemen, okay? And more than likely, it's coming from proxy near-peer competing countries. And given the Houthis that capability to fire ballistic missiles against Saudi Arabia. Okay, and so my point is that it's not the Houthis that are doing the research and development. It is a larger country with more expertise in science and technology that has given them that capability to engage that threat against us. And certainly they extended their reach in the attack into, you know, further into Riyadh. And I think the Saudi Arabian has a defense design that is set up well enough to defend, you know, the key and critical assets as they deem necessary. And if it did not engage, they might have had reason for it not to engage in a certain area of their country based on the defense design that the Saudi Arabian government has established for their country. I don't know. I think they're still at the PAC-2 level, but I'm not in the foreign military sales understanding of if they have worked a purchase and if that purchase has been delivered into Saudi Arabia. So I'm just thinking. I think it's PAC-2 because that PAC-3 capability hasn't extended across to, you know, several countries yet. So just some countries have.
I had the opportunity to be and host the Gulf GCC Missile Defender of the Year with our partners. And at that point in September, they had said since 2015 that they had intercepted over 160 missiles. And I don't know of any other combat, even Israel, that's intercepted that many during that time period. So they're effective with it. They might have missed one or two. But that's where they're going, and it's very solid. We'd like to get them more integrated, but I think again, what we're doing in North Korea, I mean, what the U.S. government's doing in Korea with that fuse of THAAD and Patriot is what is going to be the formula too. Once it's established, to go into CENTCOM as well as other areas around the world.
Sir. Been an intensification on urgency of how do we best spend the money that the president wants to give us, and we have to. I go back to my earlier point. We have to make the best. We have to offer the best military advice, working with our civilian leadership in Office of Secretary of Defense and others, and in OMB. And to make sure where do we put the right investment. And if the investment is best suited on immediate concerns, then that's where some or a portion of the investment will go. If we have confidence that we can hedge with time, then we will still continue to put that investment or a portion of that investment in research and technology. And so I know it sounds kind of just a primitive answer, but it really kind of goes back to, well, we have to look at this in time and space and in current events, at the social and the political climate that's going to be advised from outside, and then we provide that into our leadership within the building. And so the good news in just wearing our missile defense hat is that it's good when you have a few extra bucks to spend. And it's always, where do you spend? If you had one more dollar, where do you want to commit that $1? Is it always going to be in interceptors, or is it going to be in sensors, or is it going to be in missiles? Is it going to be in research and technology, or is it potentially, is it going to assist the space program, you know, that provides us early warning, missile defense, warning as well? And so that's why I go back, once again, I had to get smart on my understanding of the space community and the space environment because of the missile defense warning that layer provides as well. And it's always not just the layer that you provide or sensors that you have at your disposal, it's the external feed and the joint architecture that you have access to.
I just wanted to ask an acquisition question. The House's FY18 policy bill included a provision that would shift procurement from MDA to the services for operation of missile defense systems. In the Pentagon, where does that conversation stand? Because MDA has a lot of procurement right now. Are the services ready to take that on?
Yeah, it's still being discussed. Missile Defense Agency, once again, I wish John was here, but they do tremendous research and development. And in their charter, once they have completed, you know, the test and evaluation of a weapon system, it is supposed to get handed off to a service. But there's always, it's not always just that clean. THAAD is a perfect example of that right now. THAAD has been with MDA for, I want to say decades, but it's been a decade plus. And by law or by charter, it is supposed to get transferred into the Army. The challenge is, there's still some R&D that's always going to be associated with the THAAD program. It'll always, we want to improve it, we want to make it better. And then you give that entire portfolio to the Army. And does the Army get the entire program? So right now there's just there's a moderate impasse of how that, go back to your question on how that is going to proceed. And so that's what, it's not as easy as you think it is just because, you know, the language is stated in there, and it's to do it for the right reasons. And, you know, you could have somebody in MDA to give the argument that, yeah, we need to hand it off, and you can have the same person or another person in MDA that says, no, we need to keep it for those reasons, okay? And then the Army will say the same thing, hey, give me the full kit, or no, I don't want it yet because there's still some tails to that bill that we want to keep over here in the Missile Defense Agency. And so we figure it out, and the goodness is that the system is out there, and it's being operated and served by our men and women in uniform. It's just, you're right, trying to get those in the right pipes. So.
Anybody else? Clem, you want to make a closing statement?
Yeah, so thanks for a lot. I think we can't, whether it's 20 people or 50 or 100 people, talk about this enough, and certainly your interest this morning is always humbling, and I appreciate each and every one of you coming here and hopefully continue to carry the message and read things that are happening within the missile defense portfolio. It's, you know, the missile defense domain is certainly part of a larger and a combined operation. And it's not just, you know, we're going to settle and we're going to see, you know, 20 ballistic missiles come and we're going to fire 40, and it's just going to kind of go back for, you know, 3 to 5 days or 30 days of fighting. I mean, there's going to be certainly activities of other things happening. But what I have learned in my 28 years of service is that when we position missile defense forces in the military abroad, it sends a message, and it sends a message certainly of deterrence, but it also sends a message of host nation and partnership building with the countries that we are serving in, integration. And, you know, when I used to serve in the CENTCOM AOR, you know, I got rid of the term steady state operations because nothing is steady state. And the term I like to use is we're doing what's called shaping operations. You know, we're shaping the environment, we're shaping the options that our senior leadership has, and from from the president all the way down to our combatant commander, certainly to our warfighting commanders on the ground. And so that's what's very important about the capability that we're privileged to serve with when we're not here in Washington, D.C. So thanks again. Appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing you guys around.
Thanks, Glenn. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Thanks for taking your time to visit us. We are excited about the future of this mission, and we're going to be out front on it. So we look forward to seeing you in our next congressional roundtable next year. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Ricky.
Good job.
Appreciate it.